This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Here's what the Second Amendment says. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Since that amendment was ratified more than two centuries ago, the Supreme Court hasn't ruled conclusively on it, and they've never used it to strike down a gun law. Now, for the first time, the court may decide whether gun rights are as protected as, say, the right to free speech. The court heard arguments today in the case of the District of Columbia versus Heller. Lawyers for the plaintiffs argued that the District of Columbia's gun control law is unconstitutional because it bans handguns even for self-defense. In just a minute, we'll hear some audio from today's proceedings. We'll also hear from the lawyers who argued the case today. And we want to hear your stories. Does the interpretation of the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, have a direct effect on your life? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. The email address, talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. It is at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, late Sunday, the Federal Reserve put up as much as $30 billion to facilitate J.P. Morgan's purchase of the struggling investment firm Bear Stearns. But where does that money come from? A Fed explainer. And we'll read from your letters. But first, the Supreme Court and the Second Amendment. David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times, joins me here in Studio 3A. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn.
And David, what is the significance of this case?
Well, as you said, the Supreme Court has never ruled squarely on what the Second Amendment means. If you read the sentence like you did, I think it's possible to there are two possible meanings. If you focus on the first part, you'd think it was about well-regulated militias. There is one view that it was really intended to protect a state's right to have a militia. There's the other view that I think actually most Americans believe, which is that the right to keep and bear arms means that an individual can have a gun, even if the state doesn't want him to have a gun. But as I say, the Supreme Court has never weighed in on that question. They're going to in this case. And depending on what they say, you know, there's sort of two questions. One is there an individual right? And if they say, yes, there's an individual right, you want to know, well, what kind of a right is it? Is it like a right to free speech where it's a sort of the government has to keep hands off? Or is it something like gun control people will talk about automobiles, for example.
Mm-hmm.
An automobile is a good example. It's a legal product, but it can be dangerous. If you're over 16 and you can afford a car, you can drive on the highways, but you understand that the government can tightly regulate automobiles. You have to have a license. You have to pass a test to get insurance by the speed limits. Nobody would go to court saying, oh, you're denying my right to drive because you make me get a license. On the other hand, imagine something like a book, and mm-hmm. I said to you, you can't write a book or you can't publish a book without a license. You know, we want to make sure you're a competent writer, and we want to make sure you don't have subversive ideas. We would think the government can't regulate something like a book or a church, but it can regulate an automobile. So I think one of the interesting questions down the road is if the Supreme Court says, yes, it's an individual right, then I think there will be other cases to say, what kind of a right is this?
So even if the Supreme Court does say, yes, it's an individual right, it won't. This question won't be decided once and for all. It's going to go into lower courts, and more cases will be coming with these nuances that you're talking about.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. This would be just the beginning. If they say it's an individual right, then there'll be a long period of time where we'll be learning whether certain restrictions or regulations of gun ownership can stand against the Second Amendment challenge.
Well, let's hear some of what was said in court today. We have some tape. Now, in this first piece of tape, in his opening statement, Walter Dellinger, who represented the District of Columbia, talked about James Madison's intent when he drafted the Second Amendment.
In the debates over the Second Amendment, every person who used the phrase bear arms used it to refer to the use of arms in connection with militia service. And when Madison introduced the amendment in the first Congress, he exactly equated the phrase bearing arms with, quote, rendering military service. We know this from the inclusion in his draft of a clause exempting those with religious scruples. His clause says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country. But no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. And even if the language of keeping and bearing arms were ambiguous, the amendment's first clause confirms that the right is militia-related.
So there we have the central argument on the part of the District of Columbia in this particular case, that this is the right to bear arms is only for a well-regulated militia. Maybe you can explain why that's so key to the district's argument.
Well, this is, as I say, the first case. They want to go back to the history. What did it really mean? And Walter's arguing strongly that this really has nothing to do with an individual living in D.C. wanting to have a gun. It was about state militias, and therefore you should not find an individual right, because this is really, by its language and by its history, as he said, the phrase "bear arms" is a military term. It's not a, you know, for a hunter to have a gun or a person to have a handgun at home. It's all about militias, and you, the Supreme Court, ought to say that and stop right there.
Yeah. Now, Justice Anthony Kennedy was interested in historical precedent dating back to the English Bill of Rights. We're going to listen to what he had to say.
Let me ask you this. Do you think the Second Amendment is more restrictive or more expansive of the right than the English Bill of Rights in 1689?
I think it doesn't address the same subject matter as the English Bill of Rights. I think it's related to the use of weapons as part of the civic duty of participating in the common defense, and it's.
I think that would be more restrictive.
That could well be. The answer.
Well, isn't it more restrictive in the sense that the English Bill of Rights was a guarantee against the Crown, and it did not preclude Parliament
from
passing a statute that would regulate and perhaps limit. Here, there is some guarantee against what Congress can do.
So what's Justice Kennedy getting at here?
Well, the first one was Justice Kennedy. The second one was Justice Souter.
Okay.
Kennedy wants to say that the English Bill of Rights, there was talk at that time of a sort of right to bear arms and a right to protect yourself. Kennedy thinks that was the right way back in 1689. And it goes beyond militia. It is a right to protect yourself. So Kennedy said in that exchange and a few others, his view is that it goes beyond, it's not just about militias, it's a right of individuals to sort of arm and protect themselves.
All right. I want to play another tape. I want to get to Alan Gura, who was arguing for the plaintiff. But before, just to set this up, let's talk a little bit about the D.C. ban and what's allowed and what isn't allowed.
It's generally viewed as the nation's strictest gun law. Basically says you cannot have a handgun, either to carry around in public or have at home. You can have a rifle or a shotgun at home if it's disassembled or has a special trigger lock. Later on in the argument, Walter Dellinger said, you know, this is not a total ban on guns. You can have a rifle at home, and then there was this exchange, but can you use the rifle because it's got to be disassembled? But anyway, as a handgun ban, it's probably the strictest gun law in the nation, because there are very few exceptions for, unless you're a policeman or whatever, you can't have a handgun.
All right, let's play this tape now. This is Alan Gura arguing for the plaintiff in the case. He said that the victim of a crime doesn't have time to worry about whether or not the use of a gun is legal or illegal when a crime is being committed.
Certainly the idea that people could guess as to when it is that they might render their firearm operational is not one that the court should accept, because a person who hears a noise, a person who perhaps is living in a neighborhood where there's been a spate of violent crimes, has no idea when it is that the District of Columbia would permit her to render the firearm operational. And in fact, there is a prosecution history, not under this specific provision, but certainly under other gun prohibition laws that we are challenging here today, to prosecute people for the possession or for the carrying of a prohibited firearm, even when the police rule the shooting has been lawful self-defense.
That was Alan Gura arguing for the plaintiff today at the Supreme Court. David Savage, explain what he was getting at there for us.
Well, he's trying to knock down the argument that I said that Walter made later on, which is this is not a real ban on handguns because you can have a rifle. and Alan Gura saying that's really not a functional firearm for self-defense. If you hear a noise in the middle of the night and you have a rifle down in the basement that's disassembled, that's not going to be very useful when you really need it. His argument is don't buy the notion that this is not a ban on having a handgun, an effective gun. It is a ban on having a functional firearm for self-defense.
You know, having listened to these arguments today, and I always wonder about this, do you have a sense of where the court's going by the questions they're asking, by the direction they're going in with their questioning?
Yes. It's a sort of a seat-of-the-pants guess, because they only say a few things. But, yes, later on in the argument, Justice Stevens said he was convinced, based on what he had read, that the Second Amendment was about the notion of coming together for the collective common defense. He said that several times. He said that all the constitutional amendments, with the exception of two, Pennsylvania and Vermont, spoke of a common defense. So his view is the Second Amendment is about state militias. And Kennedy and some of the others said no, that they have the view that's much more, I think, contemporary Americans have, that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right. It's not something the state allows you to do if you join the militia. And so the best you can do is sort of listen to the way they ask questions and what they say, and you can get some sense of where the court's going.
David, why are they taking this case up now, after all this time?
It was sort of a setup for them. There was a libertarian group, Bob Levy, who's at the Cato Institute, a fascinating fellow, made a lot of money as an investment counselor. When he was age 51, went to law school, got a law degree, works for Cato, which is a sort of libertarian institute. He doesn't own a gun, doesn't want to have a gun, but he funded this challenge to the D.C. law. It was, as I say, the strictest law in the country. He wanted the court to say something about the Second Amendment, so he essentially brought this case to the court.
All right. David Savage is the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's going to stay with us. We're going to take a short break and then continue our discussion of today at the Supreme Court. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255 or send us an email to talk@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The Supreme Court heard arguments for and against the District of Columbia's handgun ban today. It is the first time the court could rule on the interpretation of the Second Amendment. Coming up, we'll hear from the lawyer who argued for the D.C. handgun ban, and you can find more coverage of the Supreme Court proceedings and learn more about the president and vice president's differing views on the case at npr.org/talk. My guest this hour is David Savage. He covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times, and we want to hear from you. Does the interpretation of the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, have a direct effect on your life? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send us an email to talk@npr.org. And we are joined now by phone by Alan Gura, who argued for the plaintiff today. He is a partner at Gura and Posesky. Alan Gura, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, if you can just give us a sense briefly of the argument that you made today. I know you can't summarize everything you said, but what's the argument you're trying to make here?
The argument we're making, and I believe that we made it quite well both in our papers and today, is that the Second Amendment was designed to guarantee people's individual right to have arms, at the very least in their home, to defend themselves and their families. This was the right that the people who founded this country very fervently believed that they had under English law. And when that right was violated by the king, people became upset, and they were very careful to remember that right when it was time to draw up a Bill of Rights for our Constitution.
What do you say to those who would argue that, you know, you need a handgun in an urban environment like Washington, D.C., which has a high crime rate?
Well, many people need handguns to defend themselves. Handguns are the most commonly used weapons in self-defense. There are some people for whom handguns are really the only option. Many people are physically frail or can't operate a larger weapon. Also, a long gun is easier for a bad guy to grab out of your hands. And, of course, a handgun can also be used while dialing for the police. And so handguns have many advantages over longer guns, and it's not surprising that many people in all 50 states where they're allowed to do so have handguns for self-defense.
I wonder, do you think we should pay attention to statistics about gun crimes? Because as I mentioned, Washington, D.C. has a very high crime rate.
Washington, D.C.'s crime rate went through the roof after this ban went into effect. We have 31 years of data on the gun ban, and it's very, very hard for anyone with a straight face to claim that this law has had any kind of a positive effect. In fact, just the opposite. We see quite a lot of social science out there which shows that if there's any sort of correlation, it's between restrictive gun laws and higher crime.
But if there are fewer gun crimes with no handguns in other places, would that be a strike against your argument?
But that's actually not the case. So we've seen in countries where handguns have been banned, you see an explosion, actually, in gun crime, because criminals still obtain guns and still use them for their bad criminal purposes. The fact is that a handgun is something that a lot of people do need to defend themselves and their families, and they have an absolute right under the Constitution to get, the type of arm which is constitutionally protected. If a weapon is appropriate for civilian use, we're not talking about bazookas and machine guns. We're talking about a very simple handgun. Then that's a choice which is protected by the Constitution.
We are talking about the Supreme Court and arguments against the D.C. Handgun ban. And if you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. We're going to take a call while we still have you. We're going to go to Mac, and he is in Oakland, California. Go ahead, Mac.
Hi. Just one quick comment. The lawyer for D.C. was saying that he was quoting Madison during the framing of the Constitution. And, I'm a very liberal person, but I am a gun owner, and I believe in the Second Amendment in both parts. When Jefferson was writing the Constitution of the State of Virginia, some of his thoughts are very, very explicit about his intent being for the people to be able to have guns. And just one other very quick thought to throw out there to liberals who don't think like me and who are afraid of guns, real quick. Most of the time when a gun is used to defend a home, it is shown to the intruder. And that's the end of the confrontation. It isn't about killing people. And I'll take my response off of you.
Okay. Mr. Guerrero, would you like to respond to that?
Well, that's certainly true. There are various studies, about 13 studies, that have tried to examine how guns are used defensively. And all of them have shown, and the numbers range depending on who's doing the study, but that there are at the very least hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of defensive gun uses every year. And most of those do not involve firing a single shot. It's often enough simply to introduce a firearm into the situation, and the criminals quickly back off. Surveys have shown that burglars are most afraid of getting shot. It's why, at least in this country, they try to avoid homes that are occupied. In other countries where guns are more restricted, that's not the case. And the very fact that we have fewer so-called hot burglaries because criminals are afraid of confronting armed homeowners has a dramatic effect on our violent crime rate. It decreases it by, I've seen one figure, about 9%. So certainly, it's true there are many ways in which guns are used without even being ever fired that are beneficial to society.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today, Mr. Guerrero.
Thank you so much.
Alan Gura argued for the plaintiff today at the Supreme Court. He's a partner at Gura and Posesky. David Savage, we have a couple of emails here that I'd like to read and see if you could respond to them. One addresses the need to protect against government control. This is from Gary in Idaho. The issue is not hunting or even self-defense. Guns are the last resort against government tyranny. Whether guns in Jewish homes would have stalled the Holocaust is uncertain, but forfeiting guns is certain disaster. And on the other side, from Tom from Oregon, I think that in the context of the time of the Second Amendment was written right after the 1776 Revolution, the colonists realized that they had to have access to arms in order to overthrow any future oppressive government as they had just done with the British. I don't know how that right would look in our present day. I don't know what arms Americans would have to own and have access to in order to violently throw out any future oppressive U.S. government. Tanks, aircraft, missiles, artillery? There you've got the divide, I think.
Well, I think that the first emailer is correct to say that there were a lot of people then and a lot of people now that argue that the Second Amendment was intended to protect a type of self-defense against a tyrannical state, an overbearing government. It wasn't just about protecting yourself and your home, and it wasn't just about an organized state militia. It was of the fear of an overpowering central government. On the other hand, as you sort of alluded to, Lynn, if you start down that road, imagine if we made that argument in Iraq and say, why don't you adopt our version of the Second Amendment? And you have an individual right as an insurgent to have a rocket launcher or kinds of military weapons. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We would find that a very troubling matter if people had a – if the Second Amendment were interpreted to say you can stock machine guns and rocket launchers to protect against a tyrannical government. I know it is a common view, and I don't know whether it's historically – there's certainly some historical basis for it. But it's, I think that's the type of – that's when you get a really sort of a controversial view of the Second Amendment, that it would give individuals a right to stockpile military-style weapons.
All right. I think Walter Dellinger is now standing by. Mr. Dellinger argued for the District of Columbia this morning. He is a partner at O'Melveny and Myers, and he joins us now by phone from his office in Washington. Welcome to Talk of the Nation. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Dellinger. Are you there? Can you give us a – we're having a little trouble hearing you. Let's see if we can get this.
Let's try this.
Oh, that works.
Better.
That's
good.
Much better. Thanks. Quickly, if you could, give us a sense of how you're reading of the Second Amendment.
Well, the argument really divided into two parts. One part was, what is the nature of the right that is created by the Second Amendment? And the second part was assuming it's the kind of right that the Mr. Gura argued for those that challenge this law. Is this law nonetheless a reasonable restriction on the right? As to the right, our position was that the amendment reflected a deep concern that the new Constitution, which had been adopted a year and a half earlier, the new Constitution surprisingly gave Congress the power to organize, arm, and discipline the state militias. And the states were surprised that the proposed Constitution went that far to give Congress, the national Congress, control over the state militias. And the Second Amendment grew out of that opposition. So that's why it's about the keeping and bearing of arms was a military term, and every single person that discussed the Second Amendment in Congress referred to it as a military right, and that's added to by the weight of the phrase the well-regulated militia, that individual rights are created, but they're rights that people have if Congress were to interfere with their participation in a common defense through a militia. And one of the most important points about the Second Amendment is that when it was introduced by Madison, he at first included a conscientious objector clause, the people with religious scruples against the rendering of military service didn't have to do so, making it clear that this was about imposing a duty to keep and bear arms. Now, our second argument was that, and really I think more of the discussion today considered the fact that suppose the court disagrees with that and holds that there is a individual right to keep weapons for reasons having nothing to do with the maintenance of a militia. And our view was that this is nonetheless a completely reasonable law because the district makes sure that everybody has a right to have weapons in their home, arms in their home, firearms in their home. You can have rifles and shotguns. The only weapon that is prohibited by this law are handguns, and they are prohibited for a very, very special reason. They're the one weapon in a densely populated urban setting that poses particular dangers because they are concealable and mobile. It is handguns and only handguns that can easily be taken onto subways, onto buses, into schools, into offices, into government buildings that are more easily accessible to children and more likely the cause of accidents in the home. Handguns are used in 90% of all armed robberies and 100% of all rapes that occurred with weapons in the year before this law was passed.
So it's, am I correct in saying, I may be wrong about this, but that part of what the argument then is that each state, or in this case the District of Columbia, has the right to determine what its needs are with regard to gun control.
We're really a step. This law involves an act of the national government, so it is possible that the court could theoretically strike down this District of Columbia law, but say that states are still free to enact legislation. But I actually think that if the court treats the Second Amendment as creating a widespread right to personal liberty to have guns for personal purposes, then it's going to inevitably follow that the court will hold that another amendment, the 14th Amendment, that limits the states, also imposes limits on what state and local governments can do. And that would be a really very major step, because for the federal constitution, federal judges then to strike down state and local laws responsive to local needs would I think quite substantially disrupt what is been a pretty good system. The political process has worked. We have fairly few restrictions on guns, and they're basically sensible ones, and ones that are half a dozen in the last 60 years have been struck down by state courts. But basically the system has not been broken. Even if there is no longer a need to have your own weapon in connection with militia service, it really doesn't strike me as an argument. One of the arguments the other side made was that our view means that there's no use, that the Second Amendment is the dead letter. I think if a state really did start a militia and the federal government interfered with it, there would be individual rights. But even if that didn't happen, you don't take an amendment that's actually not being violated and worry that you need to make up some use for it. Some of the arguments we've heard about how our position makes the Second Amendment a dead letter makes it sound like the constitutional interpretation has some kind of jobs program for underemployed constitutional amendments, when, in fact, if an amendment is being complied with, that's really not a problem that needs to be remedied. I mean, one question the court's worried about is if they seem to have differing positions on among the justices, is if they strike down the D.C. ban on handguns because it is a ban on a kind of arm that's useful for military service, what will they do about the ban on machine guns? Will this lead the court to strike down a ban on machine guns or armor-piercing bullets?
Yeah.
Some justices thought you could distinguish those. Others may not have, and we'll have to wait, I would expect, until the end of June to find out what the court thinks.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today, Mr. Dellinger. Walter Dellinger argued for the District of Columbia this morning. He joined us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. And we're going to try and get one more call in here from Nick in San Jose, California. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I wanted to provide some perspective from someone who grew up and was born and raised in D.C., myself, my family. I think one of the main points that is lost from the people who are trying to defend the right to maintain handguns is the victim case. In fact, that handguns are the cause of a lot of crime in Washington, D.C. specifically, I think was noted earlier. My sister, for example, was shot in front of her home a few years ago by random violence, handgun violence. That perpetrator was never found as that person tucked their weapon away and ran off while my sister was left bleeding and lost her leg and almost died in the process. My brother's closest friend was shot and killed in his front lawn in downtown Washington, D.C., by yet another random violent act with a handgun by someone who was just walking by and felt like killing someone. You know, they turned themselves in later. They were, you know, mentally insane. But I think, I would be very happy with this ban going in place to just remove these guns off the street from people who clearly, you know, cannot handle the availability of handguns.
Nick, I really appreciate your calling in with that perspective, because it sort of it brings us from what we're talking about at a very high level at the Supreme Court to what these things mean to people the bottom line is how it affects people in their lives often. So thank you so much for calling.
You're very welcome.
And David Savage, just a few more minutes left. How long is this going to take? When do we expect a...
As Walter said, probably late June. They saved the best decisions for last. And I would guess there's probably a 5-4 vote to say some sort of individual right, but it'd be interesting to see what that means.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're going to conclude our discussion of the Supreme Court arguments on the Second Amendment. We're joined by David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And just to wrap this up, David, what do you think is going to happen? What do you think the court's going to decide?
Well, it certainly sounded like there were five justices inclined to say the Second Amendment creates an individual right and that the D.C. law goes too far. John Roberts and Sam Alito both said this is a fairly extreme law. So I would think there's five votes to say, yes, there's an individual right, and no, the D.C. law cannot stand. But then the interesting thing will be to say, if they try to explain, okay, what kind of right is this, and what about all these other gun laws out there?
All right. Thanks so much for being with us, David.
Thank you, Lynn.
David Savage is the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times.